Good evening. Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Breaking news exclusive with Robert Bryan, Mumia Abu-Jamal's lead counsel.
Recently, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit issued the most important decision affecting Mumia Abu-Jamal since his arrest nearly a quarter of a century ago. This is the first time any court has made a ruling that could lead to a new trial for his freedom. Lead counsel for Mumia Abu-Jamal, Robert Bryan, tells us the goal is to win this life-and-death struggle and see Mumia walk out of jail a free person. However, we must not forget that Mumia remains in enormous danger. If the case is lost, he will die in the execution chamber.
Well, we are extremely pleased to have an accomplished, dedicated lawyer with us who has totally committed himself to one of the most important political cases, certainly in the history of this country. And Robert, it is our honor to have you with us.
It's my honor to be here with you tonight. Thank you very much for discussing publicly the issue of a person who's sitting on death row as we speak tonight because of his political beliefs, for being outspoken against governmental corruption. And, of course, we have to remember also that the color of his skin is a major factor as to why he's been languishing on death row for nearly a quarter of a century, as you so well pointed out.
Well, we're going to actually hear one of the extraordinary, well, it's, you know, Mumia does, which always amazes me, he does these weekly commentaries. And he has been locked up low these many years, and each commentary on the nature of our society and events unfolding in the world are as crisp, as salient, as philosophically brilliant as one could possibly imagine. And I think the best way to start this segment on Mumia is hearing some of his words. And now, Empire of Fear with Mumia, and then, of course, we'll return to Robert Bryan.
The Empire of Fear. As these words are spoken, reports are emerging of the FBI surveilling the Pittsburgh-based Thomas Merton Center, a pacifist and anti-war group named after the late Trappist monk and writer Thomas Merton. The news of surveillance of the center, discovered after the center's lawyer filed a Freedom of Information Act request, reminded me once again that the more things change, the more they remain the same. Reading from the newly released documents under the heading of anti-terror surveillance, one must be reminded of the efforts of the FBI in the late 60s, where under the ruse of anti-communism, peace groups were subjected to relentless surveillance. Indeed, according to Frank Donner's exhaustive The Age of Surveillance, published in 1981 by Random House, the abilities of a single FBI and Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police informer, one Robert Merritt, showed this tactic's dangerous potential. Merritt spied on at least 28 separate political, social, and radical groups. Among the overtly anti-Vietnam War groups were the Anti-War Union, the Coalition for National Priorities and Military Policy, and the People's Coalition for Peace and Justice. Among the other groups subject to informer surveillance were the Academy of Political Science, the American Civil Liberties Union, the American Friends Service Committee, The Advocate, a publication of the National Law Center at Washington University, the Black People's Party, the Children's March for Survival, Common Cause, the Furies, a radical feminist publication, Community Bookstore, the D.C. Statehood Party, the Howard University Committee to Free Angela Davis, the Tenants' Rights Workshop, and RAP Incorporated, a local drug rehabilitation program, among other groups. What this shows us is that anybody and everybody was suspect and subject to informants and government surveillance. Here we go again. When the Thomas Merton Center is under surveillance because of government suspicion of ties to terrorism, then we're seeing the outer limits of the arrogance of power. Secret prisons, secret prisoners, gulags of torture and death in the Caribbean, Afghanistan and Iraq, black sites in Eastern Europe, and silence? Fear immobilizes. That is its intent. But hope opens up as spring opens up the earth. Don't recreate the 60s. Make this moment, this day, this era, one of speaking out against the empire. Make it a time for joining together with others who share your fears and your hopes. Make it an age of marching against the madness that assaults our senses. Make it a chance for change, or it will be with us forever. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, author of We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Well, if you didn't know Mumia, certainly the voice, the power, the cogent understanding of perhaps one nation now under surveillance comes through so loud and clear. And Robert, you were saying he is, and clearly we can understand some of that from this kind of commentary. He is in prison by virtue of his political perspectives.
He is not just in prison. He's sitting on death row. We're sitting here, you, Ken, and myself, in this lovely studio. It's a very nice environment to be in. He, as we're talking, is sitting in a very small, dank cell. He's been there for nearly a quarter of a century. And to me, and he and I talk when I do not am not able to see him. You know, my office is in San Francisco. We talk by telephone. We talked Friday. I had a legal conference. It always amazes me what comes out of this incredible human being. You just heard it. And my reaction when I was listening to it was, wow. And these dispatches from Death Row from Amia, he turns them out weekly, one after another after another. And it's not trite, but it's very true, and that is they can imprison a person's body, but they cannot imprison the mind. And I mentioned politics and what this case is about. We cannot separate out what I'm doing legally with what Mumia is as a person, a very political person who fights against oppression and injustice, whether it be the many crimes committed by Bush and his cohorts to poverty, to racism, to this hunger throughout the world, the many things he speaks out about and against and tries to raise the level of our consciousness. And when the authorities arrested him in 1981, December of 1981, Mumia was already a well-known journalist in Philadelphia. He, at that time, was known as the voice of the voiceless because he spoke out for people who so often get trampled on by government and police, and so forth. And they thought that by prosecuting him and sticking him on death row that they would shut him up. Ironically, he's better known today than he was when he was free. And the government, just so we can keep our eye on what this is all about, the government knows if he is not killed, if they do not get him in the execution chamber, strap him down and take the very life out of him, these dispatches from death row will continue weekly being heard by this station and many stations, both here and many other countries. And the only way they can shut him down is to murder him in the name of the law. And that's really, as they say, the bottom line of what this is all about.
The bottom line also is that on the legal front, there are some very important developments that you need to verse us in so that we can stay vigilant, support them, and support Mumia, who is now on a very important precipice in the legal case and thus really in the case to save his life and potentially to be with us as a free man. Do tell us about the significance of the December Circuit Court ruling and what, of course, then is unfolding virtually as we speak.
Well, as you pointed out, Mimi, at the outset, on December 6th, the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which sits in Philadelphia, issued the most important ruling. It's the most significant development since Mumia was arrested. I think it's an indictment of our society, one of many indictments one could come up with, that this incredible ruling was not in the New York Times, was not in the Wall Street Journal. A lot of press carried it, but not the major, and even though this was a earth-shattering development. What the court did is said that it would consider and allow me and the legal team that works with me to brief and argue before the court some issues of enormous constitutional significance that could result in a new trial for Mumia. There are three big issues. One is the prosecutor in his trial summation, his argument to the jury, in effect told the jurors that if you make a mistake, err on the side, in effect what he said, if you make a mistake, err on the side of conviction rather than a not guilty. What the prosecutor did is turn the presumption of innocence, the theory of reasonable doubt, on its head. He said there will be, and these were his words, appeal after appeal. In other words, he said, now, of course, if you acquit, there's nothing any of us can do. There's no appeal. Mamiya Abul Jamal goes home. But if you convict, there'll be appeal after appeal. In other words, he was taking the sense of responsibility, removing that sense of from the members of the jury. Mamiya felt, after we had sought certification, filed some briefs, pleadings, and so forth, in his brilliant way, one day we were meeting, he said, you know, this issue, this appeal after appeal, why don't we argue that too? And I said, well, you know, the law is really against it. And he said, but if we win, it would not just help you in my case, Robert, Brian, it would help many people. And he's always thinking that way. He's always thinking about the greater good of helping other people. All right, a second issue is racism and jury selection. It's called the Batson issue, named after a very famous 1986 Supreme Court case, Batson versus Kentucky. And what that case held essentially is that it is constitutionally wrong for a prosecutor to systematically remove people because of their race from a jury. If somebody happens to be African-American and they're removed, but it's for some independent reason, then that's different. But just because of a person's race is constitutionally just wrong, unacceptable. In Mamiya's case, we know of at least 11 people removed because, in the prosecutor's eyes, their skin was the wrong color. Not one, not two, which should be enough, but 11. This is really important because racism has been a thread that has run through this case from the time Mamiya was arrested. And the fact that a federal court just below the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized and said, we want to hear more about this issue, to me is of enormous consequence. And then the third issue involves the racism and bias and prejudice of the trial judge, Albert Szabo. Szabo, incidentally, as a footnote, at the time of the trial, 1982 trial, was responsible for putting more people on death row than any other judge in the United States. And, of course, the majority just happened to be African-American. During the trial, Szabo even made the statement, this is newly discovered evidence, he made this in the presence of a court stenographer during a recess, I'm going to help him fry the, and he used the N-word in referring to Mamiya. In other words, he was going to help the prosecution see that Mamiya was convicted and executed. And he referred to him in the just most reprehensible way one can imagine. So those are the three big issues: judicial bias, racism and jury selection, and prosecutorial misconduct, the prosecutor's misconduct in his argument. And there is one other issue that's rearing its ugly head in the case, and that's the death penalty. As we know, he's sitting on death row, and that's the other big issue. The prosecution just filed its opening brief Thursday, March 16. Our brief will be due now, and we'll be going back and forth and briefs and reply briefs and surreply briefs and so forth throughout the spring. And I do not think we will finish briefing probably until at least early summer. The next step is that a three-judge panel, when I've argued before, three-judge panels, and the court, as you know, is divided up into two circuits. When you go before these judges, it's almost like going before a god. You know, they're sitting up there, and you realize that they hold the keys to whether or not your client will die or live and possibly, hopefully, go free. There will be a three-judge panel, and we will argue these issues after briefing. And I might point out, and I don't know when that oral argument will be, my not estimate but guesstimate is that it will probably be in late fall or sometime during the winter, but there's no way to really predict. This is a very, you know, I specialize in death penalty litigation. It's all I've done for 30 years, in addition to trying to be a decent husband and father, but professionally is what I do. Every case, death penalty case I handle is very complex. I've never seen one of the complexity of this case, and it's so this case is unique for that reason, along with many others.
Why? What makes it so complex out of 30 years of death penalty litigation?
Well, it's because I think maybe the overriding reason is because of the politics of the case. I'll give you an example. We were denied relief in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in at the end of 2003, latter part of 2003. So I filed what's referred to as a petition for writ of certiorari with the United States Supreme Court. And and when I look at replies, responses by the other side, I see distortion of facts. I see what we see every day coming out of the White House. I think just lies. And it's difficult. It's one thing to litigate. It's different. These cases are difficult enough, capital cases, to litigate when people are being fair and just making legal argument and arguing the facts as they are. But when things are twisted and perverted, it makes it much more difficult. And I'd say, finally, the reason your question is why this is so complex. Mamiya has been, we're in New York. I'm a member of the New York Bar, even though I'm based in San Francisco. But this is not a New York case. This is a Pennsylvania case. But the reason it's important to people here, as it is to people in France, as it is to people throughout much of the world, is because Mamiya has become a symbol for the voices, for the oppressed. And sadly for him, and this goes back to the question, your question of complexity, everything that could go wrong in a death penalty case or in a case, unfortunately, is in Mamiya's case. You've got racism, you've got politics, you've got a prosecutor who would almost sit on a client's lap to see him get fried. You've got a judge who was a bigoted, biased monster. You've got incompetent legal representation at trial because the client, Mamiya Abdul-Jamal, did not have the funds to hire a good lawyer. You have a person who, as a warden once said many years ago, the death penalty is a privilege reserved for the poor. You have a man who went on trial in 1982 who did not have the funds to hire an investigator and have a good investigation of this case, so the jury only heard part of the facts. They only heard one side of the facts, the prosecution's version. Forensic experts were not retained because he did not have funds and his lawyer did not know how to go about that. I mean, everything, I could go on and on, and that's, I don't want to take up the time going on and on about this, but everything that could go astray in a case, unfortunately, is in this case. So it's very symbolic of what's wrong not only with our capital punishment system, but also with our legal system in general.
To what extent do the judges in the case now, would they have to agree with you to order a new trial? How much of your argument would they have to accept? Would it have to be on all of three of these issues?
No,
they have to agree partly on some of them? Or, I know this is a big question, but what kind of hope do we have on that?
Ken, it could be actually any of the issues. The big one, of course, I think, that of constitutional import, and because it involves this thread or rope that runs throughout the case for so many years and so many every aspect of the case, is the racism and jury selection. That's the biggie. I think that one thing we need to bear in mind is that there are some, you had asked me just before we went on, Ken, about possible, what could happen to Mamiya? And is this a good point for maybe me to, okay. Everybody's nodding yes, affirming. Okay. There are really three major scenarios. One, we could win on the death penalty and lose on the other issues. If that happens, Mamiya doesn't go off. All it means is he goes back to the trial level, has another jury trial on whether or not he gets life without parole or death. He can't go free. He dies in prison either way, either of old age or at the hands of the executioner. So that's one scenario. Another scenario is that the court lets the death penalty remain intact and we lose on what we call the guilt phase issues. There are guilt and penalty phases of a case of this nature. Prosecution wins, we lose. What happens is Mamiya gets executed. He's dead. And I knew Tukey Williams, who was executed in California. He wanted me to represent him about 10 years ago, so I got to know him well. He had a good Batson issue, I thought, in the case. And he's dead now. He was executed. So we cannot take this for granted. And the third scenario is, and this is what I'm after, is a entirely new trial. This case goes back to square one, and with the new trial, we win, and Mamiya goes home to his family. And that's what we're after in this case, his freedom. We want a fair trial, and he's never had a fair trial.
My breath is always taken away by the magnitude of death penalty litigation, and certainly, particularly in this instance, the life of Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, which has been so momentous and so precious to all people of good conscience and goodwill, which continues to hang in the balance. We want to play another piece from Mumia. This is actually the irony, right? It's the start of spring, which should mean the renewal of life, and it's also the anniversary of the invasion and bombing of Iraq, which continues the loss of life. And once again, Mumia has something very significant to say about that, and then we'll come back for a final moment of comment from Robert Bryan.
The neocon war in Iraq. On the move. Long live John Africa. Thanks for inviting me to join you all in this international protest against this mad war in Iraq. I say mad because it was waged solely because neocons have been itching for this battle for years. In a report put out by the Project for a New American Century, the group wrote that it needed a new Pearl Harbor to launch their plots. In an open letter of January 1998 to former President Clinton, 18 members of this project called for the removal of Saddam Hussein, saying it should be the aim of American foreign policy. 9/11 provided the pretext for war. And by then, 11 of those project members were at high levels of government. They forced this war on the American people to seize the rich oil reserves in Iraq and to dominate the region directly. They brought this country and the Middle East to the brink of disaster for their own financial, corporate, and imperial ends. The promises of freedom and democracy in Iraq were as empty and as meaningless as the promises to rebuild New Orleans or to bring help to those thousands who suffered in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. That wasn't incompetence, and neither was Katrina. They both were acts of capitalism's innate cruelty, where Iraqis can be bombed, invaded, and occupied based on lies, and where African Americans can be left alone to face the full fury of nature, and then left alone again to starve, to suffer, to drown for days. Yes, stop the war in Iraq. But how about stopping the war against poor black folks here at home? Because both arise from the same source, this system. Let's build a movement against both wars. Thank you. On the move. Long live John Africa. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, author of We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Robert Bryan, you know, Ken and I, and you sit here and say, oh my God, what a remarkable spokesperson for truth and for justice and for humanity, Mumia Abu-Jamal. How shall we wind up this segment? What do people
Well, I think what I want to wind... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No,
I would like to wind up with, just as listening to this, I mean, you seem to have tears in your eyes, and I feel that way listening to Mumia. I mean, this power of how this is coming out from somebody sitting in a dank cell on death row in Pennsylvania is just phenomenal. This is a political case, and people need to continue being involved. Mumia is, and they need to make noise. They need to demonstrate, write articles in newspapers, letters to editors. Get involved. People need to be involved. We all can do something. And I think the biggest crime, the worst thing anybody can do is to sit back and be quiet and do nothing. And evil is flourishing. They're trying to kill Mumia. And people need to make noise and be involved. And I appreciate very much both of you for having me here on tonight. What you're standing for as far as getting the truth out and fighting, continuing to fight for people who do not always have a voice. Mumia does, but as I said, he's in terribly grave danger.
Continue to support. As a matter of fact, now more than ever, because we are making that final curve. We are around the bend towards whether or not it's freedom or death.
It's do or die time.
Absolutely, Robert Bryan. Thank you for your good legal work on behalf of all people who have been on death row, and certainly most specifically now, Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we will keep our listeners posted as long as we need to until Mumia is sitting here with us.
Well, thank you, Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash, on behalf of Mumia. He was thrilled to know that I would be joining the two of you tonight. Thank you so much.
Well, we're honored by you and certainly by Brother Mumia. Stay strong, brother.
And this has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.